Oh, Nina, such a lot of parties, all that succession and repetition of humanity, all those vile bodies. War was a rude snob, a bully and a rascal, but he wrote like an angel, and he and I, or at least I and Adam Symes, his hero, are as one when it comes to parties. In the gay community, to which I did not belong, despite the sexual visa issued me at birth, which told the world that I was a citizen, musical comings together were the least squalid form of finding a partner for the night and, who knows, for the long term. These comings together were in gay bars that pumped out Donna Summer, Blondie, and the Eurythmics, or in places like Heaven, down behind Charing Cross, which was supposedly the largest disco in Europe. I went to Heaven precisely once and found it hell. The noise, those awful up-and-down raking inspections that greeted you wherever you went. I knew that I fell short of the ideal, which in those days seemed to involve string vests or plaid shirts, moustaches, jeans, and plenty of muscle, the clone look, as it was known, on account of its duplicated prevalence. That one time I went to Heaven, I know, a clever name for a nightclub, one must admit, I saw Kenny Everett dancing frenziedly and happily. He cuckooed and blew me his special brand of extravagant kiss and threw back his head as if to say, "Darling," before being swallowed up in the bopping mass. I saw, too, my friend from Cambridge, Oscar Moore. He was to go on to write A Matter of Life and Sex under the pseudonym Alec F. Moran, an anagram of Romain Arclay, and to edit the film magazine Screen International. Everett continued to be sacked and rehired, every 6 months or so by the BBC. After three series, a BBC executive eventually cottoned on to the terrible truth that the name of Everett's female vulgarian, Cupid Stunt, all in the best possible taste, could be crudely spoonerized. She was forbidden from reappearing. A new, seemingly identical character called Mary Hinge popped up in the next series. "Now you see, that's better," said the executive. "You don't need to be smutty to be funny." Before too long, both Kenny and Oscar would have died painfully and unhappily. Sex. I do apologize for leaping about like this, but I did warn you. In my mid-twenties, a sexual relationship, aside from the usual schoolboy larks and nervous cottaging, had come to me but once. It took the shape of my partnership with the aforementioned remarkable, brilliant, and loyal friend, Kim. We were lovers at Cambridge, and only the necessity of driving weekly up to Manchester to work on my first television series, Al Fresco, kept us apart. Perhaps too much, for this marvellous lover in one arena loved what I exactly most didn't. The scene, those gay clubs and pubs and their music. Conversation was what I adored, sometimes even other people's. How can you converse with pump up the volume, vibrating your tummy and hoarsening your voice to a whisper that wouldn't be heard in a nun's cell? Well, I returned one weekend to find a Greco-American young man there called Steve. In a perfectly happy, loving way, I moved to the spare room in the Chelsea flat while they took the master bedroom. Yes, in those rosy years, one could live in a two-bedroomed flat in Chelsea, just between the King's Road and Brompton, a year after coming down from university. Well, I say one. Kim's parents had money, and not all my contemporaries were as lucky. Some had to live as far out as Clapham and Islington. To have been born clutching the coattails of the baby boom was to have drawn first prize in the lottery of life. I'm quite sure the young don't want my pity, but they do have, wanted or unwanted, my sympathy. Everything continued swimmingly. Steve was very charming. I didn't feel the least betrayed, and Kim and I have stayed the best of friends ever since. A perfectly accidental advantage of this celibacy and my loathing of gay clubs and pubs was that at precisely the same time I emerged from university, HIV emerged into the world too, although the first name I ever heard it given was GRID, gay-related immune deficiency. By the decade's end, I would have sat at the bedsides of many friends and attended the funerals of more. There is no virtue in my having survived the swathe of death that AIDS cut through a whole generation of gay men and intravenous drug users, any more than I am prepared to say that there was any vice in the infections and deaths of those who did succumb. Once the facts were out, it was pretty dumb to be caught by the virus, it must be admitted, but my fiercest feelings at the time were for the hysterical untruths and myths perpetuated by the tabloid newspapers. I began to involve myself in Britain's first AIDS charity, the Terence Higgins Trust, and have worked with them ever since. We mounted in the late 1980s and early 1990s three or four benefit shows for THT called Hysteria, two of which were televised. In one of those, Eddie Izzard made his television debut, in another, Vic Reeves and Bob Mortimer. At these packed-with-stars benefit evenings, the audience will be very stoked up, and when one comes on, as master of ceremonies, to announce, "And now, ladies and gentlemen, loosen your girdles and clamp your thighs, it's Mr. Rowan Atkinson, or Miss Jennifer French and Dawn Saunders, ho-ho," there will be an explosion of cheers and foot-stomping and whistles of joy and welcome that hit you like a force field. Unless the material they perform is entirely astonishing, the sound that accompanies their exit is necessarily a little less wild. This is no sign of failure, naturally. It was, then, a thrilling pleasure to announce, "I know you're going to love him. Please welcome the extraordinary Eddie Izzard." There wasn't exactly the lone cough, tolling of a bell and bouncing of tumbleweed so beloved of Simpson scriptwriters and others, but the reception was little more than cheerfully polite. His exit, though, oh my word, the audience actually stood as they cheered him off, and I, in the wings, had to push him back on to take another roar of approval. I turned to one of the producers, and we both mouthed simultaneously, "A star is born." I know, what a cheesy, showbizzy cliché, but you have to accept some. Weird truth, since I began this paragraph, an email just hit my inbox reminding me of this June's Terence Higgins Trust gala dinner. For the last 20-odd years, I have made a fundraising speech on these occasions, and before each, I have the same panic attack about what I'm going to say. It becomes harder and harder not to repeat myself. Maybe I'll cheat this year by reading out passages from this book. A surprising number of you, surprising to me because I think, despite the evidence of my passport, that I still hover somewhere between my mid-20s and early 30s, won't really know quite how disastrous, ugly, desperate, upsetting and frightening the AIDS epidemic was. The transition from being HIV positive to having full-blown AIDS, always full-blown, no one ever managed to find another phrase, meant that death was a certainty. Well, not entirely a certainty. I have two friends who were diagnosed early and seem to possess some inbuilt antibody. Naturally, virologists have swarmed all over them, attempting to determine why they are, to all intents and purposes, immune. Those dying of AIDS resembled the survivors of Nazi death camps. The gaunt, hollowed cheeks, the total emaciation, the dry, crusted lips, the dull glimmer of fear and pain and hopelessness around the eyes, and always the shallow panting from infected lungs that denied any conversation but the most banal and forcedly cheerful from visitor and visited. Perhaps the most upsetting sights I ever saw were anxious parents sitting on one side of the bed, looking down at their wasted and withered child, while on the other side sat the, for whatever reason, healthy and uninfected partner. The parents would flash sidelong glances that seemed to say, "You did this to our boy. You killed him. Why aren't you dying too?" If I had enjoyed the gay lifestyle and cruising and bars and clubs, it is very probable that I would be long dead. Anyone who ever saw someone suffer from AIDS knows it was not the release of death, but the agonizingly drawn-out manner of dying that was so cruel and unendurable. Very often friends of mine had to give their parents two pieces of shattering news in one. "Mum, Dad, I've something to tell you. I'm gay."
"What?"
"Yeah, and, I have AIDS." Imagine a family having to deal with that. I met some heroic parents along that troubled 15 to 20 years when to test seropositive, as doctors called it, was to receive a certain sentence of death. Religionists from pulpits and evangelical TV stations announced that this was all God's punishment for the perverted vice of homosexuality, quite failing to explain why this vengeful deity had no interest in visiting plagues and agonized death upon child rapists, torturers, murderers, those who beat up old women for their pension money, or indeed those cheating, thieving, adulterous and hypocritical clerics and preachers who pop up on the news from time to time weeping their repentance, reserving this uniquely foul pestilence only for men who choose to go to bed with each other and addicts careless in the use of their syringes. What a strange divinity. Later on, he was to take his pleasure, as he still does, on horrifying numbers of women and very young girls raped in sub-Saharan Africa, while transmitting his avenging wrath on the unborn children in their wombs. I should be interested to hear from the religious zealots why he is doing this and what kind of kick he gets out of it. But we are wasting time on those beneath contempt. I suppose we will return to sex at some later point, but for the moment, where are we? Before you distracted me with your fevered and filthy red herrings and irrelevant erotic diversions, we were examining that first intranasal introduction of cocaine into my system. I wrote that the effect upon me had been between zero and minimal, a slightly increased propensity to talk and a little jigging up and down of the knees. Nonetheless, that momentous evening will never leave me. We all had a second line finishing up our friend's supply. He was only an underpaid actor, after all. It was that second line that got hold. Don't misunderstand me. It didn't hook me and turn me instantly into an addict. Just a few smokes or shots of heroin won't make a junkie out of you, even if 20 or more just might. The second line gave me enough of what Freud had called euphoria and enough of a sense of energy and optimism to make me think that this was a drug tailor-made for me. The strange thing about cocaine is that it is said to cause a dependency rather than an addiction. Tallulah Bankhead put it this way, "Honey, cocaine is not addictive. I should know. I've been taking it for 20 years. Alcoholics, smokers and junkies are addicts." That is how I looked at it as the habit grew after that first simple encounter. Not one of the others in that room, all close friends, responded in the same way. There was ever something darker, more dangerous, and, let's be frank, more stupid about me than about my friends. Socially, psychologically, and inwardly stupid. Imbecilic. Self-destructive. More of a fool. By the end of the 1980s, I would no more consider going out in the evening without 3 or 4 grams of cocaine safely tucked in my pocket than I would consider going out without my legs. Yet I was, after all, able to find it perfectly simple to go to the country and write my first novel, The Liar, sitting at the computer in Norfolk for 4 months without even the thought of cocaine crossing my mind. And this was when I must have been already regularly using it for 5 years, just about daily. I dare say cocaine was ready and waiting for me, but the real reason I embraced it is that I found it could give me a second existence. Instead of performing and being in bed with a mug of Horlicks and a P.G. Woodhouse at 11 p.m, coke gave me a whole new lease on nightlife. It made me, for the first time in my life, actually enjoy parties, though still never parties with music, no matter how wired I was. So long as I had 2 or 3 wraps in my pocket and access to a lavatory that wasn't too squalid, or have too long and obvious a queue for the stalls, then I was a new, sociable, fun-loving Stephen. No longer the Stakhanovite drudge, producing column after column for magazine after magazine, voiceover after voiceover for face creams and dog biscuits, and TV appearance after TV appearance for anyone who asked. I was Stephen the party animal, always to be seen at the now-defunct Zanzibar in Great Queen Street, Covent Garden, or its famed and storied, as Americans would say, successor, the Groucho Club in Dean Street, Soho. Bed by 4 or 5 in the morning, and then up at 10, feeling fine, ready to get through the backlog of magazine articles, reviews, radio scripts, and whatever else the day demanded. There again I was lucky and unlucky. I know many, many people who profess to liking Coke, but who just can't recover the next morning and will feel like hell for 2 days afterwards. For some reason, it never had that effect on me. I would awaken with a spring and a bounce and tigger my way down to the kitchen in search of breakfast, much to the grumpy annoyance of Hugh, with whom I still shared a house at that time, along with his girlfriend and other Cambridge friends. Never the larkiest bird in the morning sky, Hugh, after a day in the gym, bed at 11:30 and not so much as a gin and tonic in between, still managed to feel like hell until mid-afternoon and 7 coffees the next day. I felt blessed. I was meeting new people at all kinds of parties, not just Coke parties with fellow Cokeheads, but ambassadorial, political, social, and geeky digital parties. I would never have accepted invitations to any kinds of parties like that without the little friend in my wallet. Paraphernalia. Not the most important issue. If you've got a gram or two about you and any available surface in which the powder won't get trapped or soaked in, then frankly a currency note and a credit card will get the job done perfectly adequately. Or you can even transfer by the corner of the card or a pinch of the fingers a bump onto your fingernail or the side of your clenched fist and sniff it in like a Regency snuff taker. Nothing can keep an addict from his supply. But for a cleaner, neater, altogether purer experience, I had put together quite the little kit. During my visits to the sound studios of Soho, for the purposes of lending my larynx to the allure of L'Oreal or the double-action brilliance of Bold Automatic, I had taken every opportunity to snaffle, when no one was looking, a useful collection of those editor's razor blades with a protective bar on the top that they used for cutting tape back in the days of old analog reel-to-reels. Whenever I passed a McDonald's, I popped in to make another haul. Ronald McDonald's red, white and yellow drinking straws, stored in glass carousel jars by the napkin and ketchup sachets, were the Coke sniffer's ideal. Hygienically protected in paper, with a wider bore than the average straw, fistfuls could easily be taken home, and each straw neatly snipped in half with scissors to make the best possible sniffing tube. Washable, too. I mean, for heaven's sake, when one is generous with one's supply, as I always prided myself on being, who knew what germs lurked within the snotty nostrils of the user to one's left as one passed the straw? Storage? I won't believe a single Coke user who tells me they haven't at least once opened their wallet only to watch with a shudder of horror their precious packet or baggie fall out and splash into the lavatory bowl below. Footnote. As with smartphones, Coke law had it that storing the damp wrap in rice would eventually dry it out, but it never worked for me. End of footnote. So, aside from the obvious advice to make sure that you always close the seat before opening your pockets and getting down to business, consider the container. For a short time, I favoured the highly fashionable, for sadly obvious reasons, condom holder. You could slip 3 well-packed wraps and a blade in this 2-piece plastic container and then slide the 2 halves together. It was compact and safe. I would keep 2 straws in the other pocket. In later years, I discovered Californian head shops, where simple grinders were on display in the window. Even smarter ones allowed you to grind out a dose and then quickly sniff it up, concealing the action behind a handkerchief. No visit to the loo, no waiting for said loo to empty, so that the sounds of one's chopping and snorting went unnoticed, just a simple, indiscernible action. Of course, buying such a thing, and several spares too, is an unspoken, even to oneself, concession of one's addiction. Incidentally, using the phrase getting down to business when describing a men's lavatory may seem a little ho-ho, but during the 1980s, the epidemic of cocaine fever sweeping through the mews, squares and side streets of Mayfair had reached such a pitch that I remember sitting one evening in the bar of the wildly successful nightclub Annabelle's when a friend, a great wit known by just about everyone in the world of London fashion and parties, a man one could genuinely call a playboy, came up from the men's room with a look of outrage on his face. "Do you know what just happened?" he asked, a frown of indignant disgust clouding his otherwise fair features. "No? Some arsehole just came into the Coke room while I was chopping out a line, and without so much as a by-your-leave, he took his cock out and had a piss in one of those porcelain bowl things. I mean, should we get Mark to fling the man out and have him thrashed on the steps of the club? That really is how prevalent the white stuff was then, and how utterly unremarkable the taking of it in public was, inasmuch as the gentlemen's lavatories of Annabel's can never be called public. Incidentally, some of the paragraphs above look like I'm writing out a template of instructions and encouraging advice for the coke novice. It should go without saying, and must be apparent if you read on and find out what damage I believe this noxious yet maddeningly beguiling substance did me, that I wouldn't recommend cocaine to my worst enemy. Which won't, of course, stop someone taking it out of context and damning me. Goes with the turf. Chap gets used to it. Barely a day goes by without someone on Twitter favouring me with the information that I thought better of you than that. The that being anything from passing on the blandest of off-colour jokes to employing a swear word that offends them, don't get me started, to using an epithet that apparently slights a minority of some kind, which I don't really get. God, there have been a lot of clever yids. Doesn't seem in the least problematic, nor does amazing how many of the greatest ever American comedians have been kikes. Must be something to do with their 2,000-year need to stay together and keep themselves amused, or whatever. Perfectly charming observations that don't need someone to say, "Excuse me, those words are offensive. Kindly use the word Jews, or better still, the phrase Jewish people." As if the latter takes the sting out of being a Jew, as if even that word is too strong. All Jewish people should be beaten up, and fucking Jews run everything. You know they conspire to keep others out. How is it better that whoever writes something so ghastly is using acceptable words? It is the sentiment expressed that is repulsive or not repulsive, not the words. Hell, I'm turning into a foaming political correctness gone mad animal. I shall shush on that topic. Paraphernalia, then, is described not for the purposes of an instruction manual, but as a warning. Permanent sniffles, blood from the nose and other unwelcome parts, sleeplessness, diarrhea, headaches, itchy skin, and on top of these indignities, that of dealing with your dealer. We'll come to that interesting, intriguing, and inscrutable being in a little while. Hold that thought. Unexpected diversion ahead. Now, this section isn't a diary. Diary entries lie up ahead waiting for you. But I do feel I have to insert here, by way of flavour, the unexpected nature of today. This day of my writing this sentence. A not untypical day in my life, except for one rare but wild circumstance. In this interruption itself, as throughout the book, there will be plenty of unexpected excursions, which I hope will not annoy. I awoke early this morning, still tingling. Last night, I experienced one of the strongest manic episodes of my life. It had been stealing up on me for some days, but last night I felt almost possessed. I texted everyone I knew furiously, knowing that safety with cyclothymia, my particular variation of bipolar disorder, lies in the support of friends and family. They can tell from one's voice how oversharp the edge of hysteria might be, and talk one down, or insist upon one accepting help. Hypomania, I know one would have thought it should be hypermania, often presents with a euphoric need to be in touch with people and a garrulity and excitable chattering manner that can make one barely comprehensible. It is, I am told, much harder to live with someone manic than someone depressed. The worst state for a family member, spouse or companion to deal with is the transitional mood that develops as one cycles between the two. I realised last night that this was what I had been going through the previous week when I had felt angry and prickly about everything. I was energetic, but in what you might call a negative manner. But last night I was so charged, flying so high, feeling so positive and convinced of my worth, that I suddenly understood historical figures like Joan of Arc and the wild prophetic ravings of Howard Beale, the radiant seer of broadcasting, played so memorably by Peter Finch in his posthumous Oscar-winning Last Hurrah in Network. I'm sure you remember the scene where, raincoat over pyjamas, he comes dripping and possessed into the network building to take up his position in the newsroom as anchorman and, live on air, stands with arms outstretched, exhorting all his viewers to go to their windows and shout, "I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take this anymore!" God knows what drivel I might have come out with had I been in front of a camera last night. If I didn't have a tiny core of sanity inside me, I quite seriously would have believed myself imbued by some great spirit. Only those who have endured or perhaps enjoyed hypomania will understand quite what I mean. I'm still today rattling away at top speed, though I dare say I will come back to revise this passage when I've either floated down, as I earnestly hope, or crashed to earth, as I worriedly fear. In fact, I haven't done any revision, except to correct hasty typos. The nature of depression, mania's sinister twin, is that it's opposite in every regard. The one gives you hope and a vainglorious, grandiose belief in the future. The other convinces you of life's entire and eternal futility. The one gives an urge to communicate by text, letter, phone call, Twitter, and personal visit. The other casts one alone into a darkened room, refusing visitors and rolling away to turn one's back on those poor, concerned ones who love you and want to speak to you. Two poles. So, I repeat, yesterday was as high a day as can be. As a matter of fact, I went to see my team Norwich City suffer a catastrophic and wholly undeserved defeat at Craven Cottage, the home ground of Fulham Football Club. How we will avoid the drop from Premiership to Championship, I don't know. And in fact, we didn't. But that is entirely another matter, and one that holds no interest for you. I mention it only because, being in the director's box in the company of Delia Smith and fellow board members and club staff, allowed me to squawk and scream and jabber and joke and yell and yodel without it seeming the least odd. By the time I got home, undefeated, even by the terrible loss of the match, I found myself in a state of unparalleled OCD busyness. You will have the pleasure of learning more about my strange mind later as we go, but for the remainder of yesterday evening I polished shoes, tidied cupboards, reorganised stationery, cleared clutter and cooked a supper which took about half an hour to plate up, so fantastically symmetrical and exquisitely layered were its ingredients. When I had finished this Adrian monkish meal, I began to feel my hands shaking, the blood singing in my head, and a pressure pushing down on my chest. I was alone that evening, so I set about sending long, long texts to those I knew best. I told them that I was manic, but that I was safe, and had no feeling that I was going to do something mad, embarrassing, or unsafe. Finally, I took the decision to text my psychiatrist, who was just returning from Marseille, and he texted back with a suggested tweak in my medication and instructions to call him tomorrow, Sunday, by which time he would be home. I slept well last night, despite such an extraordinary and quite unexpected swing of the internal weather vane. This morning I worked on a passage of this book, words tumbling furiously from me. I do hope, by the way, that this doesn't show. Marry in haste, repent at leisure, as Congreve wrote. Tweet in haste, repent at leisure, as I have learned, sorely. Write in haste, revise at leisure, as experience has also taught me. I can write drunk, but must revise sober. F. Scott Fitzgerald is said to have told his editor, Maxwell Perkins. At 2:30 in the afternoon, I slipped into a good shirt, knotted the silk salmon pink and cucumber green Garrick Club tie around my neck, selected some unassuming trousers and a pleasing jacket, and trotted over to the Criterion Theatre, that little Thomas Verity jewel box right by Eros on Piccadilly Circus, although actually it's technically Anti-Eros, but what the hay. The bar next to the theatre, the Cry, as it used to be known in its late Victorian, early Edwardian heyday, the age and locus of Woodhouse's Honourable Galahad Threepwood and his nemesis Sir Gregory Parslow, is where Dr. Watson met up with his old dresser from Bart's Hospital, young Stamford, who was to go on that very afternoon to introduce him to Sherlock Holmes. So for me, despite the hordes of Chupa Chups coloured tourists who clamber up to be photographed as they mime sucking the aluminium figure's elegantly veiled little dick while fingering his pert body, footnote, the second best in central London. The best is, of course, that of the young man memorialising the machine gun corps in Wellington Place, London. His matchlessly perfect buttocks present themselves to anyone travelling south along Park Lane towards Hyde Park Corner. One never minds a red light there. Anyway, back to the tourists. There they are, carelessly breaking the bowstrings as they clamber. But despite their moronic, thoughtless littering of the surrounding area, and despite at night drunks pissing into the trough at the base of the bronze fountain, despite all this, Piccadilly Circus, the hub of the empire, as they used to call it, is sacred turf to me. Sacred paving, I should say. I have the honour of being the chairman of the Criterion Theatre. It involves little more than a board meeting every now and then, but it is such a beautiful playhouse, and it does give me a little kick to see my name in the back of the programme, lost in the tiny print, somewhere among the producers, investors, and other board members. Our proprietor is the munificent Sally Green, whose bountiful patronage, should that be proprietress and matronage, has also breathed life into the Old Vic and the great Soho Jazz Club, Ronnie Scott's. So, I arrive at the theatre and descend to the stalls. The Criterion is one of the rare theatres where everything is underground, bars, dressing rooms, stage and auditorium, for an afternoon celebrating the life of the actor Richard Briers, who died some months ago. He was a fellow Garrickian, hence the choice of tie. Everyone who worked with him, and is still breathing, seems to be here. Penny's Wilton and Keith, Peter's Egan and Bowles, Dickie's wife Annie, and of course his daughters and grandchildren, and the great Sir Kenneth Branagh, a man as busy, if not busier, than I am, and whom I rarely get to see these days. Before the event begins, I stand gabbling away with him, for once matching him in verbal pace and energy. I tell him of my current mental state. Like so many, he responds with understanding and experience, recommending, of all things, meditation. The Kenneth Branagh I knew in the days of the film Peter's Friends would have sprayed out his tea derisively at the idea of meditation and embarked upon a hilarious, vituperative and brilliant extemporised monologue exposing the idiocy of staring at nothing and chanting Om Mani Padme Om. This is one of the many things I enjoy about ageing. I discover that I am so much less likely to find things twatty, pretentious and scorn-inducing, and I must assume KB feels the same. Just as the house lights dim, I approach the stall seats from the wrong end and have to scuttle all the way round. I am rewarded with a hard glare from Penelope Keith, who is well known for, well, it's not my place to say. She reads, however, the verse that Sir Henry Irving wrote as a farewell on his final stage appearance, a plea for the public to be charitable to lesser-known actors, very well. Everyone, in fact, is on top form as they summon up memories of a man who charmed all who knew him and swore more regularly and fantastically than anyone I ever met, never having met myself, who would count as the one exception I might boldly claim. Although the best swear I ever heard came from a close friend of both mine and Ken's, an actor who, forgetting his lines on a film set, reprimanded himself with the savage cry of "Cunting Auschwitz!" Being Jewish, he could get away with it, I suppose. Just. But it's a curse one needs to keep for a serious moment of distress or fury one can't but feel. For this person, forgetting his lines while filming was as serious and infuriating as anything could ever be. I'm afraid I'm more dilettante about such occasional lapses. A remembrance of a much-loved man without a dud moment, although it is KB who, family aside, wins the afternoon by several lengths. Celebrations, memorials, funerals and charitable evenings are not competitive, you are thinking. To an actor, let me assure you, every single opportunity to open your mouth and perform to an audience alongside other actors is always a fierce and biting adversarial combat, and do not believe anyone who tells you otherwise. Every story Ken tells about Briers, whose career direction he helped transform astoundingly to the extent of casting him very successfully as King Lear, I have heard many times before, yet I am reduced to an asthma attack strong enough to need a gulp or two on the inhaler. I laugh so much and so uncontrollably. Branner is always referred to as an exemplum of the self-regarding thespian lovey. This is rather unfortunate for me, since the Oxford English Dictionary cites my employment of the word, as it is commonly understood in reference to the acting trade, as the first known publicly printed usage. As a matter of fact, if he belongs to any class or subspecies of actor at all, I would say that Kenneth is blokey rather than lovey. He is also, and for some reason people find this hard to believe, amongst the five funniest people I have ever met. We'll meet him again later in this unpredictably juggled narrative, too. I'm sitting next to the legendary Frank Finlay, who barks out the occasional laugh. I cannot say that he was entirely friendly to me when I breathlessly took my seat at the last minute, but then he is a devout Roman Catholic, and perhaps he has heard of the debate in which I argued alongside Christopher Hitchens against the proposition that the Catholic Church is a force for good in the world. The number of people since who have accused me of being anti-Catholic depresses and upsets me. Perhaps someone reported to him that I had rudely insulted the Mother of Churches and had harsh words for the Pontiff, at that time Joseph Ratzinger, Benedict XVI, R.C. retired. I leave the event speedily to avoid being stuck with too many people. I'm sure there is no one there whose company I'm specifically avoiding, but I want to come back to this, the computer screen. My mind is still spinning, but I seem to need to share my afternoon with you, the uncomplaining reader and listener. The Richard Briers afternoon was typical in some ways of the kind of event that actors attend. Gossip and tales of thespian tradecraft and unspeakable theatrical disasters are told, retold, and mistold. Academics, spies, doctors, and lawyers are no different, give or take the dictates of their professional ethics. My life is so fragmented that I live the life of an actor, and then the next day, another life entirely. It may be the life of a writer, or that of a sort of television presenter and host. I dine with classical musicians, with restaurateurs, playmates from the old drug days, plain downright socialites, chefs, fellow cricket lovers, and newfound friends from the world of online networking. Unlike an envied and admirable few, I separate my friends and almost never dare mingle one group with another. When I do, it is usually a social disaster, like mixing drinks. I love good beer and I love good wine, but you cannot drink both on the same evening without suffering. I love the friends with whom I play or once daily played snooker and tooted quantities of high-grade pulverized Andean flake. I love the friends with whom I dine at preposterously expensive restaurants. I love the friends with whom I'm filmmaking or mincing on the stage. I love and value them all equally and don't think of them as stratified or in tiers, one group in some way higher or more important than the rest. But the thought of introducing them to each other makes me shiver and shudder with cringing embarrassment. So today, I walked away from the theatre, stopped off at a passing supermarket to buy some ice, turkey breast and tomatoes, an entirely random raid, and found myself, after I'd escaped the usual struggle with the automated checkout, unexpected item in the bagging area again, trotting along the street in the company of the sartorially point device Peter Bowles and the ever-gentlemanly Murray Watson. Footnote. Murray played the definitive Colonel Bantry all those years ago with Joan Hickson's equally definitive Miss Marple. End of footnote. So, for 100 yards, I was an actor as I tattled and swapped anecdotes with them before peeling off and making my way home and finding myself here. Still high on my own erratic and mercurial endorphins, I sit myself before you and think about what to write next. We shall pick up the thread and theme of this chapter. I mentioned in my list of shame that amongst the places I had taken cocaine was the House of Commons, and this is true. I was sitting in a low, satisfyingly old and comfortable leather armchair after a pleasant, but not too pleasant, it is a club after all, lunch with a member, we needn't drag his name into it, and expressed a wish, as we swirled our brandies happily around, to betake myself for a young piddle. The MP pointed me to a door at the corner of the room and told me to take the second right in the corridor which would present itself. I swaggeringly entered until I saw to my alarm that this was a urinal-only lavatory, and only one urinal at that. No single stall with a door. The shit, as William Morris predicted so accurately all those years ago in his utopian novel News from Nowhere, must be confined to the chamber, I thought. So, heart beating like an engine, with a slightly trembling devil-may-care desperation of the true druggie, I wiped dry of condensation the rear section of the top of the urinal with the back of my tie, chopped a line there, drew out my straw, and was just bringing it up to my nose when a merry, florid, well-lunched parliamentarian, who would never see 70 again, came in humming happily. "Sorry," I said in a rather muffled way, my shoulders shielding my shameful line. "Thing is, silly, I know, but I'm a bit pea-shy. If there's someone waiting, it just won't come." "Quite understand," the man said, cheerfully backing out. "You wait till you get to my age. Damned prostate won't let you get a drop out unless you curse and cajole it. Carry on." I took my courage in one hand and my straw in the other, and with a sort of coughing House of Commons, "hear, hear" roar, sucked in the line and straightened up. The old buster lurking outside was still tunefully and now tactfully humming. I swept away what little residue there was with my index finger, gummed it, contrived to achieve a genuine desultory wee, and noticed in shame that I had left rather a puddle for this man's feet. I dived for the taps and the towels and made my escape back to the smoking room, as I seem to remember it was called in those days. It is probably known as the Herbal Tea Salon now. Truss, Tweed and Intoxication. I may have mentioned before, in book, blog or broadsheet, that as I grew to fame, I became more and more astonished at how even apparently observant and intelligent journalists would either tell blind lies, fail to notice the obvious, or deviously ignore what was before them because it didn't fit with an image that they or their editor wished to project. One sunny morning, I was assigned to be profiled by Lynn Truss, formerly my literary editor on the Listener magazine, and soon to achieve fame in all English-speaking territories and beyond on account of her Eats, Shoots and Leaves, a declaration of war on what for linguists, and those who love language, are the ever-dancing, ever-dazzling, ever-changing particles, diacriticals, apostrophes and mutations that allow language to live, breathe, thrive and evolve. But that's another story. Lynn and I were to meet at the then very fashionable L'Escargot restaurant in Greek Street, run by Nick Lander. Lander's wife, Jancis Robinson, master of wine, caused L'Escargot to be, unless I'm wildly mistaken, the first British restaurant whose wine menus were listed varietally. Footnote. In other words, by grape variety. Sauvignon Blanc, Shiraz, Merlot, etc., as opposed to the confusing traditional British manner of listing by estate without any mention of the grape. This once pioneering approach is now standard practice, of course. End of footnote. You're very bored now, and I can see why. I am getting there. So, I arrive, and the delightfully frisky and beaming 4'9" figure of Elena Salvoni, the maitresse d', is there to welcome me. Lynn is already at the table. Now, a month or so earlier, I had decided that it was about time to transform myself. I do this from time to time, rather like Doctor Who, only not like him at all. I had reinvented myself from nerdy bookworm to thief and convict, from thief and convict back to nerdy bookworm, from nerdy bookworm to tra-la-la acting and writing performer, from tra-la-la acting and writing performer to nerdy first adopting computer user, and so on. And within those transmogrifications were so many more. My most recent mutation was from pompous, tweedy, pipe-smoking paragon of pomposity, resembling nothing so much as a Latin teacher at a school which was just going to be closed down in a blaze of scandal, to leather-jacketed, jeans-wearing, trail-bike-riding, aftershave-slapping dude who knew which bands were going to be the next big thing and could wear shades indoors without looking a prick. I know what you're thinking. Every fibre of your being must be screaming that this must not be so. But for a year or so, that is in truth how I was. The fact is, I'm sure I shouldn't be so forward as to call it Fry's Law, such drastic and dramatic outward differences cut no ice at all. any more than cosmetic surgery would have turned Heinrich Himmler into a pleasant companion for a spring walking tour of butterfly-filled alpine meadows. Anyway, at the Lescarga restaurant, I checked in my skidlid, as we crazy two-wheeler sons of bitches called them, and joined Ms. Truss at her table. We chatted amiably, old colleagues. I had a book to sell. Perhaps it was my first novel, The Liar, I can't remember. She seemed very enthusiastic. The lunch and the semillon were well above par. Princess Diana shyly swept up to the first floor dining room. Security men dotted discreetly about downstairs and upstairs tables, rendered conspicuous by their inconspicuousness. That was fashionable London in the 1980s for you. I had another appointment, and my Yamaha beast was growling for release in Soho Square, so I escaped the confining truss of Lynn and roared away, thinking little of the encounter. 2 weeks later, the issue of the magazine Lynn had been writing for came out. The first words of her copy? Tweedy Stephen Fry. I had sat in front of her, radiating Guerlain Eau de Vervin, a goatskin US Air Force Golden Bear bomber jacket creaking and gleaming about my person before I took it off and hung it on the chair to reveal the pure white, captionless T-shirt beneath, a pack of Marlboro Red tucked Brando-styly into the sleeve. My legs were sheathed in Levi 501s and my feet shod in acid-resistant, heavy-duty Doc Martin working boots. The foot joy of choice for any Soho media fashionista. Not a word yet in currency then. Or fashionisto. Not a word yet in currency now. The front upper of the left boot was already worn from gear-changing my hog, and the first word she can come up with is Tweedy. Well, who am I to tell her that she is wrong? Webster was much possessed by death. He saw the skull beneath the skin, or so claimed T.S. Eliot. Maybe Truss saw the tweed beneath the leather jacket and boots. Where others have cartilage and sinew, I have corduroy and cavalry twill, it seemed, and always will. We see in people what we want to see, and nothing can change that. The first rule of being a rebel is that you can't make yourself a rebel. It is an action, not an identity, a process, not a title. You rebel. When I was a distressed, confused, manic, disruptive, and disrupted schoolboy, rebellion did not come as a choice. It is extraordinary how some single, concentrated occasions seem to combine so many features of your life in one dreadful moment so as to stand as symbolic of your entire character and destiny at that point in time. There came one such critical culmination of all that I was in the summer of 1989. I found myself in a restaurant in Soho's Dean Street, an establishment long since passed into memory. It was called Bert's, I think in honour of Bert Shevelov, the little remembered, by most, lyricist and librettist. No, No, Nanette and A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, those kinds of works. We had booked the whole of Bert's to give Kenneth Branagh some kind of stag party, for this was a Saturday night and he was to wed Emma Thompson on Sunday at Cliveden, the country house hotel that once belonged to the Astor family and gave its name to a set of supposedly appeasement and Germanophile aristocrats and politicians that flourished in the 1930s, as in Ishiguro's The Remains of the Day, only more lively and convivial. All week, Hugh, Rowan, and my fellow Blackadderists had been rehearsing the final episode of Blackadder Goes Forth, so by the time we got down to Soho from Television Centre and the tech rehearsal, we were rather tired. I had ridden in on my rearing, snarling trail bike, which I parked dead opposite the restaurant in Bouchier Street, commonly known as Piss Alley. I worry to this day whether the lane's official name should be pronounced as spelled Bouchier, or weirdly, to rhyme with voucher. The trouble is, I don't suppose there is anyone alive who can tell me the answer. I only fret over this question because A, I am a verbal nerd who does get into a tizzy about such things, and B, I once judged a reading competition at Harrow School, which was called the Lady Boucher Reading Prize, and was most definitely pronounced to rhyme with Sloucher and Croucher, solicitors at law and notaries public. I awarded one of the schoolboys, who went by the exotic name of Benedict Cumberbatch, second prize. Second. I cannot remember the name of the boy who won first, but I hope he will suddenly burst onto the acting scene, blow Benedict out of the water, and finally vindicate my judgment. Something tells me that the contingency is a remote one, and I shall continue to look upon myself as the fisherman who let the big one go. Whichever and however, I parked my Yamaha, conveniently facing the entrance to Bert's restaurant, where Kenneth Branner and friends were celebrating his last night as a bachelor. I fully intended to be a good boy that night, for the following day we would be recording that last episode of the series of Blackadder Goes Forth. I drank no more than a few vodka and tonics, my favourite drink back then, before turning to give Ken his obligatory farewell hug. "Here," said Ken, "have this." He passed me a large glass, half full of whiskey. I really... go on, down in one. Oh, well, here goes. I swallowed it all down and weaved my way through to collect the skid lid and gauntlets that, together with the previously described goatskin leather jacket, were all that might come between me and a skin-peeling moment, as two-wheel riders call anything from a slight loss of the back wheel to a somersault over the front onto the road. This was a time when motorbikes swarmed over London streets. The soi-disant service industries were thriving in post-Big Bang Thatcherite Britain, especially, of course, in London. The internet was in its hobbyist infancy, and fax machines were limited. I described the ubiquity of the motorcycle courier in the still-in-print and still entirely fascinating Fry Chronicles, brackets available in audiobook form, close brackets. The noise and smell of them was all pervasive, the motorbikes, not the chronicles, which are but lightly and pleasantly perfumed. And library footage of the era reminds one with a start how empty of them the metropolis now is. The delivery of scripts and documents could be achieved no other way, and many a student topped up his or her savings by haring about the city on delivery runs with scant regard to his or her pedestrian safety. I suppose we riders were easy meat for the busies. I crossed Dean Street, pulling on the gauntlets and pushing the tightly fitting crash helmet down over my head with a smack on its crown, unjacked the beast and swung my leg over. I started the engine and was just easing forward when a heavy hand descended on each shoulder. Fuck, I was going to be mugged. My adored motorcycle was going to be stolen. If I revved the engine and tried to escape, the bike would jerk forwards and I would be left behind in Wile E. Coyote mid-air before thumping to earth with a coccyx jarring thud. I turned to face the aggressor. Double fuck and 20 rotten arseholes. Uniformed police. What the hell? Another constable stepped forward from the shadows, signalling with a throat-slit gesture for me to cut the engine. I complied, jacked the bike up, prepared a charming and conciliatory smile, and pulled off the helmet. The helmet, most unfortunately, almost airtight with the visor drawn down, which it had been, released right into the face of Second Constable a warm, aromatic ball of something malty, peaty, and Scottish. "Oh, dear. Oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, dear," said Second Constable to First. "Whiskey." First Constable had released his grip from my shoulders and allowed me to swing from the bike. A van was parked opposite the Groucho Club. "You seem to be tottering a little unsteadily as you cross the street to your motorcycle, sir," First Constable explained. I knew he was giving me his due cause explanation. Since the repeal of the ancient sus laws, which had given the police the right to stop anyone on suspicion, a plausible reason had to be given. The police are very good at plausible reasons. Not the 9 o'clock news had made merry fun with them on that very head some years earlier. Walking in a built-up area in a loud shirt, and so forth. It was no good my protesting that I hadn't tottered in the least. Crossing a street while donning a crash helmet is not a task easily undertaken, and while I may have wound and wove this way and that a little, it was certainly not in a manner that would cause a reasonable onlooker to suspect me of being under the influence, Ossifer. But none of this was of any use. They had me, and doubtless they were going to invite me to blow down a tube of some kind. Two vodka and tonics, doubles, and one very large whiskey. Would that propel me over the limit? It was shock enough to think that a bike rider would be stopped at all. One of the reasons I had bought the damn thing, I reflected, was that I had had the idea that it would offer me a modicum of freedom from police interference. A white tube was attached to a device, and I was invited to exhale. This reading indicates that your blood alcohol level is over the legal limit for the operation of a licensed motorized road vehicle, sir. We will now take you to the main station, where you will be asked to offer another breath sample to a lionizer machine. This will be compared to the reading you have given us. The lower of the two readings will be used. If you do not wish to blow into the lionizer, a blood or urine sample is acceptable. Failure, however, to provide any of these is a criminal offence. Do you understand this, sir? I nodded. Second constable took my helmet and gloves, opened the rear doors of the van, and hauled himself in. I was invited to sit on the bench opposite him. First constable went round to the driver's seat, and we moved off. It was only as we turned right into Old Compton Street, which you could do in those days, that I realized my predicament. In my left-hand jacket pocket was a condom holder containing 3 grams of the best quality cocaine, bought yesterday with a view to larks and fun at Clifton. Surely I was certain to be searched or asked to empty my pockets when we got to the station. I slowly moved my right hand to the jacket's right pocket, where I had some mints. This, I hoped, was where a decade of being obsessive about magic might pay off. I pulled out the mints and offered the bag to Second Constable while at the same time putting my other hand into the left pocket and curling my fingers around the condom holder. A very simple act of misdirection which seemed to work. Thank you, sir. And if you don't mind, I'll keep these. Nothing is allowed in your mouth until you have completed the lionizer test. I'm sure you understand. Of course. I spread both hands wide in a gesture of complete comprehension. The condom holder was now on my lap, and I was leaning forward, allowing the groin crease of my trousers to conceal it in the half-light of the police van. So, which station are we going to, if I may ask, officer?
West End Central, was the reply.
West End Central. How grand. I had heard of it. The name cropped up in news reports and police dramas. George Dixon, of Doc Green, would often say to his son-in-law, Detective Sergeant Crawford, played by the eyebrowy Peter Byrne, Now, Andy, we don't want to go treading on West End Central's corns, and things like that. Famous as it might be, I had no idea where it was. Somewhere central in the West End would be a good guess. It was a pleasant surprise when we drew up in Savile Row. As I had hoped, Second Constable rose to his feet before me. I stood up fractionally later, just as the brakes were applied. I slapped my hand to the metal roof of the van, and my right foot stamped forward to give me balance. Oops, I said cheerfully. My foot had kicked the condom holder deep into the shadows below the bench I had sat upon. Surely it would not be discovered for a few days, by which time dozens of malefactors would have had rides in the van. I sprang down and allowed myself to be led into the station. Relief flooded me. Whatever punishment might be meted out for the infraction of driving a motorbike with a glass or so more alcohol in the blood than was permitted could not compare to the scandal, shame, possible imprisonment and career ruination that would follow the discovery of 3 whole grams of a Class A drug on my person. It was generally understood in the druggy world that 1 or 2 grams would be taken to be personal use, but that much more might be construed by a bolshie or ill-disposed policeman to be intent to supply. The first might result in confiscation and a warning. The second would certainly, if the judge was in accord, lead to a prison sentence. 3 grams lay on the borderline, and although my poor, stupid, addicted mind was running through a plan to get hold of my dealer between now and tomorrow, I felt well rid of my stash. The lionizer gave a reading that was just over the limit, and I hoped for clemency. They led me into a room where a female sergeant was sitting across a desk. She asked me to empty my pockets. I complied with scrupulous obedience, turning the pockets inside out.
From my inside jacket pocket, I drew a wallet and 4 tickets for the following day's audience recording of Blackadder Goes Forth.
"Oh," said the sergeant, "you're doing another series, are you?"
The problem with new series of Blackadder as they came along was that people were used to the one before. They were never broadcast until all had been recorded, so when the audience came into the studio expecting to see Queenie's throne room and Blackadder's low-beamed chamber, they were puzzled by the Regency wallpaper of Prince George's suite. Our audiences over the last few weeks had come expecting Mrs. Miggins's pie shop, and we had to hope they would get used to Captain Blackadder's trench and Melchett and Darling's staff HQ. I saw my opportunity. We were given 4 studio tickets every week as a matter of course, and I hadn't yet thought about whom I might invite.
"Would you like to come along to a recording? It's at BBC Television Centre tomorrow evening, as it says on the tickets."
I pushed them forward. The sergeant looked up, and first and second constables nodded enthusiastically. They came forward to collect 1 each, and she kept the remaining 2 for herself.
"Right," she said.
"Well, you were over the limit, Mr. Fry, so we will be charging you with the offence of driving or attempting to drive while above the legal limit or unfit through drink. It says in your driving licence that you live in Islington." Well, so much for the corruptibility of the Metropolitan Police. I was scandalised. Was no one to be mistrusted? And so much, too, for the slow turning of the mills of justice. I would be expected to make an appearance on Monday morning, complete with insurance documents and licence, at Clerkenwell Magistrates Court, which, as it happened, was situated at the end of Duncan Terrace, where I was house-sitting for Douglas Adams. I was not to drive home on the motorbike, but could collect it the following day, Sunday morning. I descended the station steps, crash helmet and gauntlets under my arm, thinking furiously. I wanted the next day to drive my Aston Martin V8 Vantage to the BBC and then, after the Blackadder recording, to motor down to Clifton, as one imagined Asquiths and Grenfells doing back in the palmy days. At some point I would need to meet up with one of my 3 tame coke dealers who might be induced to rendezvous either at the BBC. In that event I must remember to get another studio ticket, I told myself. Funny if they end up next to the policeman and woman. Or somewhere in Soho early tomorrow as I collect my bike. Perhaps they could come to Islington tonight. Damn, I realised that I should have brought my mobile phone with me. I rarely took it on the bike as its bulk prevented me from taking anything else in the limited storage area. Anyway, I would somehow get hold of a wrap or two of good gear, get happily wrecked at Clifton, and then up early next morning, that is if I went to bed at all, and gun the Aston, perhaps for the last time in a year, back to London in time for my court appearance, which was fixed for 11 a.m. Then, another truly dreadful thought crashed into my mind. Suppose they found the condom holder under the bench in the police van, saw that it contained drugs, and then brushed it for fingerprints. As I had a criminal record, footnote C, Moab is my washpot, end footnote, mine would be on file. But no. If they picked it up, they wouldn't do so with gloves. It was a van, not a crime scene. They would be lucky to find any latents, surely.
"Mr. Fry! Mr. Fry!"
It was the police sergeant. I turned to see her standing at the bottom of the steps, waving her arm above her head.
"Yes?"
I approached her nervously.
"I believe you left this in the van, sir."
She pushed the condom holder into my hand.
Be careful, sir, and thank you for the tickets."
I simply did not know what to say. It was already too late to disown it. She turned with an inscrutable look on her face, leaving me standing there, my mouth opening and closing like a landed fish. A taxi was rattling towards me from the Piccadilly end, so I hailed it and climbed in. En route to Islington, I privily and gingerly slid apart the 2 halves of the condom holder. There, perky as a stripper's tits, lay the 3 wraps. I could have sworn they winked at me. To this day,
I am at a loss as to the how and the why and the what the hell of it all. Did the sergeant think it rude to open a private condom holder in this, the age of AIDS? Did she open it and think, hell, I'm about to go off duty, I just can't be asked to bust this man. We already had the paperwork on the drink driving, so we had to follow through. But this, not inclined to blight his chances. I shall never know, unless she happens to read this, in which case she is very welcome to be in touch. I do not watch myself in old films or television programs, or even new ones, unless I'm in the cutting room and a part of the process of putting them together, but if I do catch, it is repeated so often, the final episode of Blackadder Goes Forth, the one which ends with the Blackadder trenchful finally truly going over the top, and the image of a field of poppies bleeding through to the sound of raking machine gun fire, and a final mournful version of the Howard Goodall theme tune. If I do catch it, or a scene from it, I cannot but say to myself, that was the day after I was busted for drink driving. The day after the woman police sergeant handed my coke back to me in a condom holder, cool as you please. And that evening I took the Aston down to Clifton, parked it, and parted through the night in honour of Emma and Ken's union. And the following day was the day I lost my licence for a year. Waiting for my man. I have always, since I can remember, been a, what word does one choose, a handful? No, that's a bit nannyish. A rebel, too cool, a transgressor. The John Buchan generation would have called me a wrong'un. An outsider is the closest I can come to it. Perhaps it is just that, as those who had the pleasure of reading the opening chapter of the Fry Chronicles will know, I was a pre-teen crazed with a love of sweets and never felt I had enough money for them. This triggered an addictive path upwards, a desire for the illicit and the unattainable.